Coming up on Broadway Radios this week on Broadway, we talk about the Commons of Pensacola, what's it all about, the story of my life, Sherry, the curious case of the Watson Intelligence, La Soiree, Annie, as well as ideas for the next NBC Live musical. Please stay tuned. Hello and welcome to Broadway Radios this week on Broadway for Sunday, December 15th, 2013. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, his most recent being Strippers, Showgirls, and Sharks. His columns appear at MTI, Critchland, Masterworks, Broadway, and many other places. Peter, aside from all that stuff that you do, you have a very busy week coming up, right? December 19th, 20th, and 21st?
It's not the 19th anymore. One of our actors got a commercial, and as a result, he's certainly going to do it. But it's very nice to have an actor who's wanted by so many people. Uh-huh. So as a result, anybody who is planning to come see my play, Adam's Gifts, on Thursday the 19th, please stay home. We're going to do it on Friday the 20th at 7 o'clock, as we had promised. But on Saturday, we're doing two performances, one at 2 and one at 7. This is at 81 Christopher Street, St. John's Lutheran Church. Adam's Gifts is a very different take on A Christmas Carol, very different indeed. And William Parry, Maureen Sullivan, Philip Hoffman, Julia Peterson, and Hayden Wall are the entire cast, A Christmas Carol with five people. And I think it's going very, very well. We'll see what you think. So if there's one thing I cannot stand, it's a critic who cannot be criticized. So it's your turn to come and tell me what you think.
Great. So, Peter, is there a reservation line? They go to the Adam's Gifts website, or how do they?
Yes, adamsgiftstheshow.com. adamsgiftstheshow.com. So there's an S on Adams, there's an S on Gifts, theshow.com, and reservations can be made there. It's free. A donation we're asking for, but this is something that is sponsored by St. John's Lutheran Church. Every Christmas they like to do something for the community, and they chose my play this year, and I'm very glad they did.
Great. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com as well as many of the places on the internet. Hello, Michael.
Good morning.
Good morning. So let's jump right into it.
Yes.
Peter got a chance to see the Commons at Pensacola. I know that Michael and I think Ken, we talked about that a few weeks ago. But Peter, what's your take on Commons at Pensacola?
Well, it's very nice that Amanda Peet, who we've admired so much as an actress, has decided to become a playwright as well. And she certainly has picked a subject that is of more than moderate interest. I did notice this week that the Bernie Madoff scandal happened precisely 5 years ago this week.
Oh, wow.
So, that went fast, didn't it?
So this would be a good week to see the show.
It is, because it deals with this type of situation. While Blythe Danner isn't quite playing Ruth Madoff, she is playing a character like her. And even though we had a wonderful play earlier this year about a gentleman named Tom Durgan, who essentially was Bernie Madoff, now we're seeing it from the wife's point of view, what it's like when your husband disgraces you and completely changes your lifestyle. I will say one thing that surprised me. There's a lot of talk about how terrible circumstances she's now living in because she's had to move from her sumptuous house to this doleful apartment, which looked lovely to me. But the point I know is that when you've been used to this phenomenal house, you know, with servants, to have to go to something that's essentially a one-room apartment is a terrible, terrible handicap. The famous statement of it's hard to be poor, but it's harder to be poor after you've been rich applies here. But
what is that? What is that musical theater song? Is it from what show is it from? Is it from Minnie's Boys? Rich is Better?
Sure. Yeah, it's a good song. Yeah, Rich is wearing underwear that didn't used to be mother's, you know, I mean, excuse me. So as a result, that's what we're dealing with here. The woman has two daughters, two grown daughters. One of them is portrayed by Sarah Jessica Parker, and she is staying loyal to the mother. She feels bad for the mother. While the other daughter has completely washed her hands of her mother, figuring, you must have known about this. You must have. Also figuring into the equation is a daughter. The one who is not speaking to her has a daughter who is speaking to her. So there's nice sorts of familial complications here, as well as the fact that Sarah Jessica Parker has a new boyfriend who's terribly young for her, about 20 years younger. And why is this boy so interested in Sarah Jessica Parker? Well, could it be that he wants to do a story on this Ruth Madoff character? So there are a lot of nice complications here. And I tell you, I was really into it for the longest time. And then suddenly the play ended and it's as if she just got tired of writing it. That's where it failed for me. After about 80 minutes, it suddenly came to an end in a way that I wasn't particularly interested in having it end. Oh, there are some surprises. And I also should mention that Lynn Meadow, who's directed, I don't think he's done a very good job in a scene where — this is so hard to talk about without giving away everything, but nevertheless, there's a thing involving hidden money, and somebody's trying to find hidden money. I'm going to be as vague as I can here. Mm-hmm. And the way that one character tries to prevent the other from finding the hidden money would make it very obvious to me where the money was hidden. Yeah, I guess that's the best I can do in describing that part. Blythe Danner is very good. So is Sarah Jessica Parker. So are they all. It seems to me that what we have here is an excellent first act, and maybe a little longer than a first act, but nevertheless, I was interested in what happened after those lights came down and people started applauding.
Well, Peter, I don't remember if you were on when we discussed it a few weeks ago, but I said something along the same lines. I kind of felt that maybe there were some – I had the feeling that maybe there were some major cuts very late in the rehearsal process, because it was quite short, and it seemed like – and it did end very abruptly.
Oh, you felt that too, huh?
Oh, yes, yes. Oh. But I also said – and again, I don't remember if you were here – that one thing that I really enjoyed was that I thought Blythe Danner was 100% credible as a Jewish mother, mm-hmm. whereas in the film of Brighton Beach Memoirs, I thought she was absolutely not credible for a second.
I agree.
So I don't know. I think that's very interesting. I guess maybe she worked on it more, maybe as she's gotten older somehow. But I really enjoyed it. And of course, we don't see Blythe Danner on stage nearly as much as we would like to, nor Sarah Jessica Parker. So I really was very glad to see it. And I do think there's a lot of talent evident in Amanda Peet as a playwright. I just think that maybe this was, you know, maybe it should have been worked on a little longer. It's worth noting it got, I believe, a rave review from the New York Times. So not everyone agrees with us, but I do think that it could have been maybe workshopped a little more to use that dreaded word.
It's funny that it just occurred to me this very second, when you were starting to talk about Blythe Danner, the first professional review I ever wrote involved Blythe Danner, who was nobody then. What had happened was I had joined a newspaper in Boston, and because I was a low man on the totem pole, they said, go out to Dennis, Massachusetts, which is pretty far away. Yeah, go out there. It sounds terrible, so we're sending you. It's a comedy about a blind boy and his girl. I mean, my God, you know. And I came back and I said, this play is so terrific. And they thought, oh, God, what have we hired? If he thought this play about a blind kid and this woman who comes to care for him and his mother who's – well, the play was Butterflies Are Free. And it was really interesting that that was August of 1969. And 2 months later, that play was on Broadway. That's all it took. And it ran for well over 1,000 performances. And by the way, it was also an important stepping stone in the career of Stephen Schwartz, who, because his agent, Shirley Bernstein, that's Leonard's sister, said to him, look, they want a song. Why don't you submit a song? It's got to be called Butterflies Are Free, you know, and which, by the way, is a quotation from Dickens. And, you know, submit it. and they took it. And so while many of us think that Steve Schwartz's debut in New York was Godspell, it was actually 2 years earlier with the title song To Butterflies Are Free, which even wound up in the movie version. So, but I remember being so intoxicated by Blythe Danner, who was just young and lovely and just tremendous. So, I forgot that this really takes me full circle as a reviewer.
I think in the play they say the quote is from Dylan Thomas.
Oh, I meant Butterflies Are Free.
Yeah, the Butterflies
oh, really?
Are Free.
You think it's yeah. Dylan Thomas? Oh, okay.
Yeah, because I directed it, and I remember she goes
right.
on, and he
okay.
tells her that, and she goes, oh, I didn't realize I could quote Dylan Thomas.
Uh-huh. Okay, I'll concede that.
But I'll have to check that again. Mm-hmm. That's great, Peter. I've mentioned before, I saw the original Butterflies Are Free on Broadway, but Blythe had left, and I saw Gloria Swanson.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But I did
obviously
see...
Obviously not in the same role. Right, yeah.
I'm sorry. I saw Gloria Swanson as the mother, and Pamela Bellwood, yes, was Blythe's role. But then just a couple of years ago, they did an anniversary, I guess. What anniversary would it have been? Let's figure it out. An anniversary production reading of Butterflies Are Free at the Westport Country Playhouse, and with Blythe now playing the mother, and with Jonathan Groff as her son. So that was really extraordinary.
How nice. Yeah. And by the way, Eileen Heckert wasn't in it when I saw it. It was Maureen O'Sullivan, who really was very good, I'm sorry to say. And I wasn't surprised when she was replaced. I never saw Eileen Heckert do it, except, of course, in the movie, for which she won an Oscar. So,
me neither.
Yeah. So anyway.
All right. Well, let's move forward. Yeah, I'm asking Michael to tell me what's it all about.
Yeah.
What's it all about is playing at the New York Theater Workshop through January 5th. And Michael got a chance to see it. So, Michael, is it all the rage and the buzz that everybody's saying?
I thought so. I really enjoyed it. I got to it late, but I'm glad I did. I hope it has a future life somewhere. I wouldn't say it's a Broadway show. Although, you know, who knows?
I'm hearing rumors.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's very, very creative. It was put together by this fellow named Kyle Riabko, who was in Hair on Broadway. And he is a very talented as a singer, musician, and arranger. And what it is just a whole raft of songs by Burt Bacharach and Hal David. And it's basically a review, it just seems to have a through line. It's very theatrically presented, with direction by Stephen Hoggett, and it has all of that the kind of wonderful little movement choreography that he has become noted for. And the most interesting thing about it for me is that the arrangements are very modern, and yet they do not betray the original songs in any way. I don't even think they do anything as radical as putting songs into different time signatures. I mean, if something was in 3/4 originally, it's still in 3/4, and if it was in 4/4, it's still in 4/4. But they somehow, you know, Riabko does subtle things to make them sound very modern and yet also very recognizable as the original songs, and such an incredible list of terrific, terrific songs. So I enjoyed it thoroughly. The setup at New York Theater Workshop is very intimate. They have, in addition to the regular seats in the theater, they have a bunch of couches on the stage that some of the audience gets to sit in and see it from that perspective. And I just thought it was very, very creative. And it's certainly the first good Bacharach review that I've seen. There was the one that was on Broadway at the Roundabout, which was a disaster of epic proportions. I'm
terribly sorry to say. I don't even remember the title. I think I blocked it out. And then I think there was another one that I did not see, but that apparently also was not very good. So third time's the charm, if this is the third time. And I highly, highly recommend it.
All right. So as I mentioned, I hear rumors that there's going to be an afterlife on it, and it is playing through January 5th. New York Theater Workshop is a small space, and it's a hard ticket to get. So we'll have to see if it.
We're getting more and more announcements of things coming to Broadway, which I hadn't even heard about. There is this show called The Velocity of Autumn.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That was supposed to come in this past year. And I actually had forgotten about that until I did my research. And it's back and it's coming in. It's a play with Estelle Parsons and Steven Spinella. So that's one less theater.
Yeah, that's going to be April 21st, opening at the Booth Theater.
Yeah, but that's where Glass Menagerie is. So I guess rumors of that extending beyond the spring are not true.
Hmm.
Well, I'm delighted that Estelle Parsons is coming back to Broadway, and I'm still disappointed that the Tonys didn't give her an honorary Tony when she was doing August Osage County, because I could never climb as many stairs as she did. But I mean, more to the point, I mean, she has been such a wonderful Broadway performer for more than 50 years, and she's never received a Tony. She's had nominations, although I certainly would have given it to her for Miss Margarita's Way, which I saw really close to 10 times, I think. So as a result, I'm delighted she's coming back, and maybe this will be the time she wins her Tony Award, and I hope she does.
Mm. Well, you know, the film of August Osage County is starting to gear up and getting a lot of buzz right now. So
sure is.
I wonder if that will put another spotlight back on Broadway, insofar as this is where it came from.
Yeah, I hope so.
All right. So next up on our agenda, we have The Story of My Life, which is not really the story of my life, but the Delaware Theater Company has a new production with Rob McClure in it. Peter jumped in a car and went down to Delaware to see it. So tell us about it.
And got back just in time for rehearsals. I really did. I love this show. And one of the things I want to say about it involves my liner notes for the original cast album. When this show was done, I think about 4 years ago, maybe more. I guess it's probably more. But anyway, it ran a week, less than a week even. And I remember the producer saying to me, we could go on, we could, but we're going to use that money to do an original cast album because we really believe that the cast album will help the show to get out there. We really believe that the show will be seen in a lot of places as a result of that album. And it's true. This is not the first production I've been offered since it closed on Broadway, but it is the first one I've seen. And it's a wonderful little show about two friends, two childhood friends. And it deals with the fact that as time goes on, that friendship isn't what it used to be. And we've all had experiences like this. And I think it really does teach us that friendship is something that should be cherished. And the way I feel about old friendships, and I have plenty of them. I have one dating back to the 50s, a few from the 60s, many from the 70s, is that old friendships are like national historic landmarks that indeed, just as we don't tear down our buildings that we cherish, I don't think we should tear down our friendships either. I love the speech in Merrily We Roll Along when Charlie talks about how friendships have to be watered like plants, you know, and they have to grow. And I believe all that. So this show speaks to me. Anyway, in my liner notes, I had put in that at the point, there's one point where Thomas has gone on to become a best-selling author, while Alvin has stayed in their small town where they grew up and is running his father's used bookstore. And now Thomas says, hey, why don't you come to New York? You know, we'll have a nice weekend. And the closer they get, the more Thomas realizes, I don't want this to happen. And finally, he says, Alvin, don't come. And what I mentioned in my liner notes is the day I saw the show, the final Saturday matinee, that the audience gasped. You know, that they were so into this show that they felt so bad because Alvin has a big song about how he's looking forward to it and it won't be long now and this is going to be my Independence Day and who thought that I could ever leave this small town. I mean, he really is very reclusive in his own way. He doesn't have many friends. He's very eccentric. That's established too. And when I'm telling you, the gasp in that audience when he said, don't come. Well, anyway, on all that chat, somebody took issue with this and said, oh, I don't believe that anybody gasped at that moment. You know, I'm gonna play. And there were a few things about that, you know, where this was doubted. And I offered to take a polygraph test to indicate that it really had happened. So believe me, I was interested in seeing what would happen at this performance in Delaware. And I will take another polygraph test. They gasped. Afterwards, I spoke to Rob McClure, who was playing Alvin, the friend who's left behind, and Ben Dibble. You may not know the name Ben Dibble unless you are a Philadelphia theater goer, because believe me, he's a big star in Philadelphia as well. He should be playing Thomas. And I brought this up and they said, every performance we've done, they've gasped at that moment. And, you know, that's quite an achievement, really, for these authors who did the show.
Yes.
Brian Hill was the book writer and Neil Bartram did the score. But that's really an achievement, because when you think that, that's a pretty small incident. We always hear about how musicals should be about big characters and big events. That isn't true here, and it may be one of the reasons why the show hasn't become a big Broadway hit. It also, frankly, did seem like an off-Broadway show in many respects. It's only a two-character show, and it's one set. But the fact is that if you can get an audience to really, really get into a show to the point of which the big drama is, you know, don't come to New York. I mean, really, you know, I mean, that is pretty significant. The work is extraordinarily intelligent. It's extraordinarily literate because, of course, we're dealing with one author and a guy who runs a used bookstore. So these people are into words. And there are plenty of wonderful ones in Neil Bartram's lyrics. And while I guess I can't seduce many people to go down to Delaware this next week when because that's when they're running, they're closing this weekend. I mean, because I know everybody's busy with Christmas shopping and coming to my play anyway, so I will say that if you get a chance to see The Story of My Life in your hometown at a community theater or a regional theater, please take the opportunity to do it. And how wonderful for Delaware to get two actors of this quality. I have no idea. I rarely go to Delaware Theater Company. This is my only third visit in 16 years. But nevertheless, I would say that these are two of the more accomplished actors they've had there. And I hope I'm not insulting people who usually appear there. But nevertheless, you know, here's a Tony nominee in Rob McClure, the guy who did Chaplin, who was just so recently wonderful in Honeymoon in Vegas at Paper Mill. It's great that he went down there to do the show. And as I say, Ben Dibble, too, who really is quite a star in Philadelphia. So good for everybody. And you know, once you drive down the New Jersey Turnpike, it's not much of a distance from there. So really, you know, I do recommend it highly, and I hope that everybody who's listening gets a chance to see it someday, because a story about a bromance, so to speak, that doesn't go as well as it might is a pretty impressive story.
Peter, I never did get to see it, but I read about it at the time, of course. And it, correct me if I'm wrong, just to clarify, the reason that he initially invites him and then tells him not to come is that then we then see sort of flashbacks to their relationship, and we see we understand that he's thinking he's having second thoughts. Is that right?
It's the term outgrow is definitely used, and it's a term I hate in terms of friendships, that I've outgrown him. You know, I wish that concept didn't exist.
Thomas invites Alvin, right?
Yes.
And then I guess he thinks about it and then disinvites him?
Yes, that is what happens. But right. The flashbacks you're talking about happened long before that happened. We get to see their relationship long before that incident happens. And we find out that when they were kids, they were both kind of eccentric, and that's what drew them together. But it is, of course, you know, as time goes on, people change. And of course, you know, what we once feel for a person may change as well. But on the other hand, I think loyalty should trump everything. And this is a story about that, how eventually Thomas realizes he should have been more loyal, because there was a time when this guy was the most important person in his life. And I don't think that should be thrown away so casually.
By the way, speaking of literacy, let me throw in, I just now realized that I was wrong in correcting Peter about the quote, butterflies are free, because, yes, she actually quotes both people. She says,
is that right? Oh, I see.
The butterflies are free, blah, 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 blah. And then she mentions Harold Skimpole. And he says, and Don says, oh, yes, that's a character from Dickens' Bleak House. But then later on, she says, I would not go gently into that good night. I would rage against the dying of the light. And he says, oh, that's Dylan Thomas. So
I see.
Okay. My mistake.
So something tangential to Peter's experience at the Delaware Theater Company is that the governor of Delaware, Governor Jack Markell, has tweeted that if you're looking for something to do this month, support and check out The Story of My Life at Delaware Theater Company with Rob McClure and Ben Dibble. So it, I'm not sure if he saw it or if he's just plugging it, but it's interesting that a governor of a state is getting involved in regional theater.
This should go on more often, Frank.
Yeah, absolutely.
I do hope I get to see it somewhere, because it sounds like the kind of thing that would have tremendous resonance to, you know, because who really, Peter, as you said, I mean, it's wrong, but who doesn't have at least one friendship like that?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, absolutely. And between the three of us, I can't believe we haven't had Rob McClure on the show yet. So we have to do that in January. Yes. In between when he's Story of My Life and in Honeymoon for Vegas. So we have to get him on. All right. Michael got a chance to see Sherry at the Signature. So, Michael, why don't you tell us about that?
Oh, this is a wonderful, very unusual show. Is that the word for it? It's I think they're building it as a multidisciplinary piece by Martha Clark. And what it consists of is basically it is a dance piece primarily by Alessandra Ferri, the very great renowned ballet dancer, and Herman Cornejo, whom anyone who knows ballet will know these two people. Alessandra Ferri is a veteran ballet dancer, and Herman Cornejo is significantly younger. And this is a story about an older woman having an affair with this son of her best friend, very, very French. So it's just a series of solos and duets of these two. First, we see them very much in love, and then what happens is that the mother of the young man, you know, she's okay with the relationship, but she feels like it's not something that should continue forever. So she sets her son up with a younger woman, and then he leaves the older. Sherry, by the way, is the name of the son. It's Cheri, which would be the male form, not Cherie, which would be the female form. So Sherry leaves Leah, played by Alessandra Ferri, for a younger woman whom we never see. And then, you know, there are other plot complications that are really very, very interesting. This is based on a novel by Colette, by the way, who also gave us Gigi. So those of you who are fans of that show should see this, although this is much darker, let me tell you right away. So the interesting thing is that the only dialogue comes from Amy Irving, who plays Sherry's mother, Charlotte. And she comes on between the dance scenes to sort of tell us what, you know, what is happening. She speaks in the guise of this role of the mother. And she tells us what their relationship is and how she sort of changes that and what happens thereafter. And it's really very, very well done. Only about 70 minutes long, and featuring beautiful music on piano, played live on piano, music by Ravel, Debussy, Monpou, Poulenc, and then even there's even a Wagner piece. I don't know what that's doing in there. But lovely, lovely music and you know, great dancing for those of us who don't get to the ballet very often. It's a wonderful opportunity to experience Alessandra Ferri and Herman Cornejo. And Amy Irving is someone else who is not on stage that often. It's always lovely to see her, and she looks amazing, I have to tell you. So I would say yes. Check this out at the Signature Theater. Something very, very unusual and very creative and very interesting.
When I interviewed Amy Irving some years ago, she was doing a show at the George Street Playhouse. I mentioned the fact that she was, after all, the daughter of Jules Irving, who for a while ran Lincoln Center Repertory Theater. And I asked her about that. And she said, oh, when I was a little girl, I used to be backstage all the time watching those shows. And they did a production of Danton's Death. That was the first one that he did, that her daddy did. And that, in case you don't know, is a play by George Buchner. And she then went on to give a monologue from the play, which she knew by heart still all these years later. I mean, 30 years had passed, close to 40, and she just rattled off the entire monologue, and I bet she could still do it if you ask her about it. So that's pretty impressive. And I'll tell you, it was funny interviewing her, because you could see while interviewing her, she's waiting for you to say, so tell me about Steven Spielberg, you know, and I never do things like that. You know what I mean? It took her a long time to relax. But when I mentioned, you know, her father running Lincoln Center, that was far more welcome than anything that I could have mentioned about Steven Spielberg. So,
and I'm pretty sure her father was running it when I saw Twelfth Night there with Blythe Danner as Viola.
Blythe is coming up a lot today, isn't she?
Yeah, it's a small world sometimes.
It is.
Wasn't it then called the Repertory Theater of Lincoln Center?
That's correct, yeah.
But it wasn't really repertory?
Oh, no. Theaters use the term repertory simply meaning regional theater now. I mean, and after all, New York is a region, too, so it can have a regional theater.
Oh, okay.
But yes, Repertory Theater of Lincoln Center was the official name back then. And but when they started, the first couple of years, at least, they were doing repertory. But even that first year that... By the time Jules Irving and his partner Herbert Blau took over, they were just doing show after show after show. But the first couple of years when it was Elia Kazan's theater, the first year after the fall, the Arthur Miller play was mixed with a play by S.N. Berman called But For Whom Charlie. What a terrible title, But For Whom Charlie. That was and I believe Eugene O'Neill's Marco Millions. That rings a bell as well. So anyway, that first year and the second year, I think, were just the years of repertory. And, of course, repertory is so expensive. But, of course, those of us who are really into theater love it because, you know, we can see like four plays in 4 days, you know, if they do it right, you know. So it is kind of sad. At least we're having the experience somewhat this year with Twelfth Night and Richard III and No Man's Land and Waiting for Godot. So, you know, there's a quasi-repertory feeling on Broadway this year, so that's
I'm
nice.
Sure Peter remembers, and I think we've discussed how for the first several years after it was built, the Vivian Beaumont Theater was considered pretty much a white elephant.
Absolutely. There was talk of tearing it down.
Yep.
There was, you know, imagine, you know, so all you need is the right guys to run it, and they apparently have them now.
Apparently.
All right, we're going to move forward. Peter got a chance to get down to Playwrights Horizon and see Watson Intelligence, which is also known as, I have the full thing here, The Curious Case of the Watson Intelligence. So, Peter, tell us about that.
It is a curious case, what a funky idea. A playwright named Madeline George noticed that the word Watson shows up a great deal in the world. After all, we know Dr. Watson, the trusty sidekick to Sherlock Holmes, which I'm sure musical theater fans know, not just from Baker Street, but also from Drat the Cat, where there's a song called Holmes and Watson. So, and of course, there's Watson, who was Alexander Bell, Graham Bell's assistant. Watson, come in here, I need you. That famous opening line, that the first line ever heard in a telephone wire, from one room to the next, you know, when they were trying it out. So that's great. And not only that, Watson was the name that was chosen for that computer that was made that went on Jeopardy.
Yes.
And went against Ken Jennings, the guy who had been on, you know, what was it, 7 or 8 years? It seemed it anyway. You know, so, you know, what the playwright does is mix and match these three completely different situations with two people named Watson and one machine named Watson, and also deals with a new Watson, somebody who isn't famous, who's somebody who's really into technology and is just looking for love. So there's a lot of time travel-y type stuff that goes on. And this is one of those plays where at the end of the show, when the people come out for the curtain call, you say to yourself, there were only three people in this show? Are you kidding me? I mean, that's what's so wonderful about it. The John Ellison Conley, David Costabile, and Amanda Quaid play so many parts and so many times are indistinguishable as the people you just saw in the previous scene that you really cannot believe when only three people come out. I mean, you really believe that some of the actors who you had just seen obviously needed quickly to go to the bathroom because where are they? You know, I mean, so it really is quite wonderful to see these people do this, that, and the other thing. I can really appreciate the fact, the person I took, by the way, was in the night air at 9 o'clock, could not take it, thought it was truly terrible. I was fascinated by it. And I just like seeing vignette after vignette after vignette that really built and really had a lot to say about each era and the people in it. But frankly, I'm very much interested in making something of fictional characters, expanding them, taking them into places that they haven't known before. Certainly this hasn't hurt the show called Wicked, where we got a completely different view of the Wicked Witch, who we only see very quickly in the Wizard of Oz movie. So I like this type of thing amazingly. And so I was really pretty interested in what was going on. And unlike the Commons of Pensacola, where I felt that we got short shrift, I felt it all weaved together very nicely and came to a very satisfying conclusion. And I'm not going to tell you what exactly happens, but I will say that it is worth visiting to see what happens. And I hope you don't agree with my friend, but agree with me if you do go.
Well, certainly it's something that I would be very interested in seeing.
Because you relate to Ken Jennings?
Because I relate to Ken Jennings, not really. But because I actually have done a lot of research on the Watson computer that IBM did. And the playwright actually visited IBM to, quote unquote, visit Watson. So there's a nice video at the Playwrights Horizons website that I will link to in the show notes. Check that out.
Nice.
It's playing through December 29th at Playwrights. So get down and see it if you can. Next up on the agenda, Michael got to see, I'm going to butcher the French, La Soirée.
Oh, La Soirée. No, that was good.
Soirée at the Union Square Theater. So Michael, take it away.
Again, I got there late, but I'm glad I did. I went last night. The weather outside was frightful, as the song goes, but it was packed. I think that word has gotten around. It is a wonderful show. I did not see the Spiegel tent thing that played a few years ago, but Peter and I's mutual friend Kevin McInerney, with whom I went, said it's some of the same acts, and if not necessarily some of the same people, but also a lot of new acts too. It's a, you know, kind of a very modern new age circus along the lines of Cirque du Soleil, except much more intimate space. The setup for the Union Square Theater in this case is very much in the round, and there's quite a small raised stage in the middle of the space. But what happens on that stage is really kind of amazing. There are two guys who what would be the word for it? It's just an incredible show of balance and strength. The things they do with each other, the way they hold each other and support each other. At one point, I don't think I've ever seen this before. At one point, one man is standing on the top of the other one's head. Mm. I mean, I don't even know how that's physically possible without causing tremendous mm-hmm. injury to the person on the bottom. but they do it. And, you know, they do it. There were two shows last night. There was one at 7 wow. and one at 10. Wow. I mean, it's incredible. And then there's Juggler, and there's a lot of comedy, and there's a lot of it's a very sexy show. It's very much not for children. Some of it I found a little more vulgar than I thought was necessary, but for the most part, I really loved it. And there's a lot of male flesh, a lot of female flesh. And here's a hilarious thing. We're sitting there, and one of the skits involves a woman who's portrays this very aggressive wannabe actress, and she pulls a fellow from the audience to do a scene with her, and the scene turns out to be sort of a mashup between the meeting, the balcony scene from Romeo and Juliet, and the balcony scene, or the fire escape scene from West Side Story. Uh-huh. And it gets to the point where all of a sudden music starts, and what is it? But it's the soundtrack recording of Tonight from the film of West Side Story with Marnie Nixon and Jim Bryant singing, and they're lip syncing to it. So I had no, I was, and the audience just loved it. And the guy who was from Haiti, the guy she pulled up, I thought he must have been a plant because he was uh-huh. so good, but I was assured that he was not. And anyway, they do the lip syncing. And so I got home and I called up Marnie Nixon and I said, "Are you aware of this?" And she hadn't heard of the bit. She hadn't heard of the show. So I said, "Well, you really should check it out because it's a really wonderful little homage." It also has almost all of the music is recorded, but it also has two other show tunes because it has The Sound of Music. I don't know if that was added, in recent right. days, because I don't think so. I think it was probably always there. And it, you know what else it has? It has that song Feeling Good, which is from which show, Peter?
Roar of the Grease Paint, Smell of the Crowd.
Thank you so much. Yeah. So that's I thought it was nice to have three show songs in there, and there's also some opera, and it's a wonderful show. I highly, highly recommend it. I'm not exactly sure of the ticket prices, but I'm pretty positive they have to be quite low compared to what you would pay for a Broadway show. So please consider it as another option. And Union Square Theater, as I think we have mentioned it before, is very historic because it used to be Tammany Hall. Mm-hmm. So you will be, aside from everything else, you'll be in an incredibly historic space, which they've really reconfigured. And I think now it can be set up in very different ways because it's a completely different setup than we saw in what was the show with Will Swenson and the one set in the bar.
Yeah, begins with an M. Murder Ballad, was that it?
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. Yes, thank you so much. Yeah, Murder Ballad. So, yeah, I think it's a very malleable space now and very useful to them. It's not – I don't know if they can even do proscenium anymore the way it's set up, but it's really interesting to see what they're going to come up with there for future productions.
Well, yeah, because this has really become a destination for the strange, atypical show.
Yeah.
Slavish snow show. I mean, all these things that seem to be off the beaten track, karate type demonstrations. I mean, this is where they go. And this place really has become very much known for if you want something off the beaten track, that's where you go. You go to Union Square and you go to the Union Square Theater. I mean, there was a time when it Roundabout was there and doing a few shows of a conventional nature, and I don't mean that as a slam. But nevertheless, it really you know when you get an invitation to the Union Square Theater, you're going to see something that is out of the box. So that's kind of funny, too.
Kevin reminded me that the Laramie Project was there because that was a show that played there. And again, at that time, it was a very traditional proscenium setup.
Yeah.
No more.
Yeah, you just never know what the setup's going to be when you walk in there. You just know. So.
Did I see The Subject Was Roses there?
Yeah, that sounds right. I think so. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's the last traditional show I saw there. Mm-hmm. Which was great.
Yeah.
I can't even remember. Was it 10 years ago or?
Oh, at least.
At least.
I'm pretty sure Visiting Mr. Green was there. Remember that one?
Yes, indeed.
Yes, it was. And that's right. And that's when I interviewed Eli Wallach in the theater. And he was the one who told me it used to be Tammany Hall. And I was like, kidding me.
And Bat Boy? Was Bat Boy there?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Bat Boy, yeah. Yeah, it's a nice space, you know. And the Darryl Roth just a few doors down.
And the Vineyard.
And lots of great stuff happening right there. CSC just south of 14th Street.
Right.
Yeah. You know, this New York thing, it might catch on.
Well, that used to be, as we know from several shows, if not from our studies in school, 14th Street used to be the center of...
That's right.
You know, New York, New York nightlife and everything.
Right, that lyric shows up in Hello, Dolly.
Yeah.
Like 14th Street.
And, you know, Broadway crosses right through it.
Sure.
Right through the middle of Union Square. All right, so let's move forward here. Peter got a chance to revisit Annie at the Palace Theater, which is playing through January 5th. So, Peter, did The Sun Come Out Again?
It sure did. I went because I do a column for Music Theater International every Friday, and this is an MTI show, so I thought I'd write about it because it's closing and saying, here are some ideas from the show in case they appeal to you. And also, of course, as somebody who saw Faith Prince when she was just starting out at Don't Tell Mama, I have great affection for her, so I thought I'd go see her as well. And while she was fine, and she really was, no question about that, she was doing exactly what she's supposed to do. I was really taken by this girl named Taylor Richardson. Now, this was the 14th production of Annie I'd seen since I saw the original tryout at Goodspeed back in 1976. So I had never seen anybody who could touch Andrea McArdle. And I truly believe if Andrea McArdle had not been there to do Annie back on Broadway in 77, that Annie wouldn't have turned out to be as significant as it turned out to be. You really needed the right kid to start it. And that she was phenomenal beyond belief. And since then, I really haven't been taken by anybody. And while I can only say that Taylor Richardson is very, very wonderful in the part. I can't say that she's Andrea McArdle either, but still, this she definitely is in a strong second place position to be just phenomenal. And I was very, very glad to see a kid who really had everything. She had the voice, she had the sensitivity, she had the guile, she had the street smarts. So that's what really turned out to be impressive. And I also have to say, I felt like I was in that theater for 10 minutes for each act. It really moved so wonderfully. I know James Lapine took a lot of heat for a lot of his ideas, one of which I'm crazy about, because at one point in the first act, after Annie loses Sandy, and she does, during the police raid on Hooverville, a little later, she's with Grace Farrell, and Sandy runs across the stage, and Annie points to him, saying, "Oh, gee, that's my dog." A little later, Grace Farrell sees Sandy without Annie is not there, and she says to a dog catcher, "Hey, can you get that dog?" Because really, when you think of it, in the Annies we've always seen, at the end of the show, when that dog shows up in that box, wait a minute, how'd that dog get there? And she never mentioned to Daddy Warbucks that she lost the dog. I mean, how did that happen? You know, and it's one of those things we don't even care because we just love this happy ending that works out so wonderfully. So I was really very, very impressed that Lapine thought about that moment and made something of it. I also have to say that Justin Patterson, an actor you may not know, is now playing FDR, and he's terrific in the part, just terrific. And he really has that wonderful Roosevelt accent down pat. So you know, I got to say that if you have kids, because I imagine everybody who's listening has certainly seen Annie, and maybe your kids have not. And I did take a 12-year-old girl who had a wonderful time, it's in great shape. So we only have a few weeks. January 5th, it's all over. But not that Annie won't be with us after that somewhere in the world. But nevertheless, on Broadway, in this reasonably lavish production, it's still certainly worth seeing.
Wow. Well, I'm glad to hear. I know you like that idea with the dog. And I'm really glad to hear and not surprised to hear that some of the replacements are doing better, maybe if only because hopefully Lapine is not around anymore, because I thought it was the worst direction I had ever seen in my life. I was aghast. I could not believe that man put that show up on stage and got that. Really just, I'm sorry, I have to repeat that.
Yeah.
It was appalling, really appalling, and just a tremendous waste of time and money.
Peter, do we think we should put that Tracy girl into Annie? What's her name?
Tracy Chimo?
Tracy, the...
Girl from Bad Jews?
No.
Oh.
That's who I thought you meant. Who do you mean?
Back to our joke about over Under the Rainbow? Was it Under the
Rainbow?
Enough said, James.
Maybe it's just that Michael doesn't like that theater.
No,
I don't know. We'll
also, see. I'm told that she's kind of disappearing off the face of the earth. So,
all right. Do either one of you guys have the cast recording? The new cast recording?
Yeah, and you know, it's very effective because the conductor really puts a lot of zing into it. The overture really has a bit more, well, of course, there are fewer instruments, and that's what happens these days. The fact is, the tempo is really, really good in that overture, and I like the recording quite a bit.
Great. So, like we said before, it's playing through January 5th, so you only have a little time left to get down to it if you're going to get down to it. So next up, we want to talk about the news of the week and something that's dominated the theater discussions that I've been a part of is NBC is going to do another musical. And so the discussion has been, what should it be? And Peter, do you have any thoughts on that?
I wouldn't be a bit surprised if it is Annie, frankly, because that's a family-friendly show, and it certainly has a brand name. The two strikes against it, of course, would be the fact that it has that lousy movie and not much better, in my opinion, TV version that came out several years later. So that is one that may cause a problem, but the thing one has to remember too is that for the most part, Annie involves interiors, and I think that's going to be a decision maker for the next NBC broadcast, because a lot of people did complain about how crummy the hills look dead in The Sound of Music in this broadcast. So I think interiors are going to be an important consideration. I haven't heard that. I'm just guessing, but I can see where it would be a wise decision to go for a musical that has a lot of interiors, and that's certainly one of them. So while people have said, well, Peter Pan, I don't know, it's going to be hard to do a good-looking Neverland. A lot of people have said Oliver. A lot of that takes place in the great streets of London, and we'll see. But I wouldn't be a bit surprised if it's Annie.
interesting, though. I'm just thinking now, as you're just saying this, how would they do the NYC
number? I was just going to say the NYC number.
Because that's done so theatrically on stage. And, of course, in the movie version, it's a different song, and he brings her to Radio City Music Hall. Mm-hmm. So that would be a big challenge. But I understand why you say that. And really, if they get the kind of property they're looking for, there's a very limited number because they want something that's family-friendly and also has a lot of beloved, very well-known songs in it. Oliver does seem like another obvious choice. I think The King and I.
That's a good guess.
You know, certainly. Because and it would be one, because although the film for what it is one of the most beautiful films of a musical, I think. Sure. They cut out
sure.
two or three really great songs. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that would be a wonderful opportunity for them to have something that's I mean, I think it should be done, if only for that reason, to preserve those songs, including one of the most beautiful songs ever written for in the history of the world, I Have Dreamed. Mm-hmm. Imagine a song that beautiful being cut out of something, mm-hmm. You know, and only because of time constraints and whatever. So that, I think that would be great if they cast it right and it was well done and well directed, as this one was not. That would be great. What about West Side Story? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not kid friendly, I guess, but on the other hand, what kid doesn't know West Side Story? You know, I mean, it's tragic, but yeah, and yet somehow it's very, it's everyone seems to know it, you know. And again, the film is tremendously famous and highly regarded, but that didn't stop them from doing The Sound of Music. So I think that might be another option.
I have a feeling that the camera would feel constrained with all the dancing, so I wouldn't think that would be terribly likely. But I do think The King and I is one that you may have heard it here first, folks, that The King and I will be the one to do it. I think Michael's impulse on that is really a very smart one.
Oh. Yeah, well, you know, with this, it's still on the slate at Lincoln Center Theater, so who knows?
Well, that's
maybe
right,
they well, but you know, maybe they could postpone that for a year, and if someone does a TV version of The King and I, you know, but there again, I hate to sound like a broken record. Maybe they could just do a really excellent live telecast of the Lincoln Center production. I think that. You know, as I said last week, people complained about the outdoor sets in The Sound of Music, and even some of the indoor sets. People complained that the whole thing looked like a soap opera because of the way it was mm-hmm. digitally filmed or whatever. But I didn't hear those complaints for South Pacific or The Light in the Piazza from Lincoln Center, because your expectations are different. So I think if they did that and they'd really spent, you know, a lot of time working out very interesting camera angles, which they can do. And, I've seen that done. I think that might be a really, and then they'd have the live audience response. And I wish they would consider that. I don't know if I know it's different from what they did this time, but I think it might be really, really fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
My brain is locked up with so many different possibilities. Mm. But The King and I is such a great thought. I hadn't even considered
they could
that.
Do. This is a different thing, but they could do The Wiz. That was talked about. I think that Marin and Zayden were talking about that for years before this new way of doing it was decided. And what else? Fiddler had been mentioned. They even mentioned Victor Garber, their friend, as a possible star. So that's another one. Fiddler's an excellent possibility.
Trying to think of what star casting they would do.
What country star they're going to put in Fiddler on?
Yeah. Well, if they did Annie, they could put Honey Boo Boo into Annie. So
yes.
Well, you know, Fiddler does take place in the country. So
the Duck Dynasty guys could do it.
I would say, can I say something positive about Carrie Underwood?
Sure.
Aside from everything else, I didn't feel a moment when she seemed like, you know, she was from the southern United States.
Yeah, that's fair. Right. Yeah. Good point. Yeah. Good point.
So
yeah,
so I props agree. Props to her for that.
Oh, was the replay last night?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I haven't heard any rumblings about it. I certainly didn't see it, but okay. We'll have to see what those numbers are like next week, and we'll chat about that. So before we wrap up, there's been a discussion on Facebook, on Twitter, and various different places that Mike Daisy and a few others had been talking about folks who work for free in professional theater, whether it be at Sleep No More or down at the Flea Theater and things like that. What do you guys think about this whole thing about these professional for-profit productions using free labor?
I think it's hard to discuss it because every situation is so different, and every position that these people are in, the kind of duties that they're doing, I'm sure are very, very different. So where does, you know, education leave off and exploitation begin? For what it's worth, I recently read something about this issue, non-theater related. I mean, it's certainly not only the theater that uses interns in positions that some would consider to be not appropriate. I mean, the person is supposed to be learning about the business, and I guess everyone has a different ideas of what kind of duties they're supposed to have and what limits there are supposed to be to their duties. But many of them do things that someone would normally be paid for. So I don't know. I mean, I guess maybe the ideal intern situation is as an assistant to someone, but, you know, an assistant to someone and learning what they do and how they do it, not just, you know, not just making photocopies and you know, running mm-hmm, to the mm-hmm. down to Staples. Mm-hmm. So I find it difficult to discuss for that reason.
Well, I've certainly done a lot of work in my time for virtually no money, but my policy has always been, I am like the Museum of Natural History, where when you walk in, it says, pay what you wish, but you must pay something. And I think that's a very good policy. So as a result, I would hope that anybody who's working in any field, and I understand, yes, it's a glamour industry, and isn't it fun to say you're associated with a theatrical production? Somebody should be paid something. You must pay something, because otherwise you're inherently saying that what you're doing is worthless, and that's not fair, and that's not right, because it is worthless. And it's really exploitation to use people and not give them anything on the promise or the assumption that you're part of this great, wonderful world of theater. That only goes so far. And good Lord, I mean, since there's so much talk about raising the minimum wage for people who work at McDonald's, look what we're talking about here. So as a result, yes, pay something. It needs to happen.
So I think about all the different various venues around New York City where if you usher, you can see the show for free, and seeing the show is sort of your payment. And I see that it fits in. I believe that fits in with what Peter is saying, is that there's a benefit on both sides there. And a benefit to the organization and a benefit for the person who's, you know, sort of volunteering their time.
Well, you know, too, if you really want to work in the theater or any other field for that matter, I guess it really is worth working for nothing, just to get the foot in the door. Because, you know, if you take a job at McDonald's and you're making money there, yeah, all right, you're making, I'm talking about real kids now, I'm talking about like people who are in high school, you know, I mean, your friends are making a bit of money, but where is it going to lead to? I guess, you know, you could move up in McDonald's, but, you know, is that really how you want to spend your life? So as a result, it even if they do give you nothing, you really have to understand that, it is a foot in the door. Maybe somebody will just think you're terrific. And I always point out the fact that when Bill Gates and Ted Turner, you know, started their businesses, they lost money for the first few years. You know, they did. You know, and a lot of people doubted what they were going that they would ever be successful. Everybody has to lose money before they make money. It's just part of the world, and you could consider it that way. So that's the other side of the ledger. But, you know, I mean, I've listed the credit side of the ledger, the debit side of the ledger. Okay, what's my my balance? I do believe that they should be paid. But, you know, the older I get, it's like Tevye in Fiddler, when he hears both points of view and says, you're right, too. You're right, too. Yeah, yeah. So I find it very much harder as time goes on not to see every side of a situation.
Right. And as I said, I mean, don't you think, Peter, that exactly what they're doing has a lot of bearing on it, you know, whether it's exploitation or whether it's education.
Right.
All right. So let's leave it there. If you're a listener who has an opinion on this, we encourage you to go to BroadwayRadio.com, and there's contact information for Peter, Michael, and for me. And let us know what you're thinking there. Also, while you're at Broadway Radio, there are links to some of the things we've talked about today. Lots of things that show pages that we're linking to. So we've linked to What's It All About and The Story of My Life and Commons of Pensacola. Each one of those pages that these theaters are putting up productions they're really starting to get put some great effort into them. And a lot of them have YouTube videos, as I mentioned, or other types of media that you can listen to or photographs from the productions. So if you don't get a chance to see the production or if you just want further information, it's becoming really great resources. Companies are putting a lot of effort into it. So check it out. So at Broadway Radio, you can subscribe to these podcasts by clicking on the link for subscription. It'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes every time we get a new episode of This Week on Broadway. You could also listen to us on the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device, when you stream it there. Or you can listen to us on Broadway World Radio. Broadway World plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. So on behalf of Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.